Welcome to Actual People, a podcast hosted by me, Chauncey Zulkin, dedicated to meaningful conversations about the evolving landscape of our lives and the power of our own creativity and imagination to make magic. Welcome back. Today, I'm sitting in a cabin in the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains near Chimney Rock State Park in North Carolina. My kids are sitting on a couch with a blanket over their laps playing checkers while our little rescue dog Jasper takes a mid-morning nap. The password for the Wi-Fi code in this cabin is watery sky something something something. Adjectives like these are always used to describe the way these mountains fade into shades of blue and gray in the distance. You've got the Blue Ridge Mountains, which is what I'm looking at, and then you've got the Smokies. They used to be called the Iron Mountains, but they're all really named for the same thing, or a chain of the same thing. The Blue Ridge Mountains becomes the Great Smokies at mile marker 469 on the Appalachian Trail. This is a 250-million-year-old mountain range, and it's the second oldest one in the world. And it's also the one that divides the East Coast from the rest of the country. When we first moved to North Carolina, we took advantage of that quiet time during the pandemic to explore North Carolina, renting Airbnbs along the Appalachian Trail in this state and also up in Virginia. We also went to places along the coastline in North Carolina, discovering all of those beach communities. I was already writing about the Japanese artist Hokusai, who painted 36 views of Mount Fuji in different seasons and from different angles, when my kid's father sent us a picture of Chimney Rock from the exact same view as a picture we took yesterday. But his picture was taken earlier in the season when the river was high, the lake was full, but the trees were less dense. I was also already thinking about how there are a lot of perspectives that you can trace over and over to find the depths and contours. It's like reading a book at one point in your life and then reading it several years later, and it becomes a different book completely. Usually, in retrospect, you can see everything more clearly. Relationships, jobs, family, and grief. I have a long list of specific topics I'm going to continue to cover on Actual People that deal with the creative industries and the cultural moment that we're in, but all of them stem from my personal experience and questions I have. So I thought I'd take today to focus on my father. I know I've talked about him several times on this podcast, and you know by now that I absolutely adored him. And you also probably know that he was flawed like the rest of us. I've actually been thinking about the saying, nobody's perfect. It's something you're supposed to tell your kids, that they don't have to be perfect, that perfection is the enemy. But what if we are perfect? What if this is what perfect is and not that other thing? Our mistakes and our pain, our efforts, our learning, our doubling back, our looking back, maybe these are the things that make us perfect. Like the mountains spread out in shades of blue and their soft lines and slopes with their bare patches and fallen logs and newly formed buds. We are all perfect, just like that, as is our grief and our memories. We are just as perfect as a mountain range. So today, sitting here looking out at these mountains, I'm going to share an essay that I wrote about my father 3 months after his death in November of 2019. I'm just now beginning to grieve his death, and so I thought it would be interesting to look back on an essay that I wrote when I hadn't even begun to process it. I also thought it would be good to share with you because maybe you understand what it's like to go through grief in different stages and observe the different shapes and contours of what that really feels like and how you can make sense of it by retracing it. So here it is, without further ado, it's called Let It Happen, Reflections on the Death of My Father. I hope you enjoy it. One summer when I was 14, I was in the south of France walking along a promenade above a rocky beach when I heard a commotion down below. There was this girl, and she was running up and down the shore, screaming and pointing. The current had pulled her dad toward these large rocks. There was a seawall beyond the beach, and he couldn't get back in. He had been pulled out with the current. And the Coast Guard finally got to him, and they brought this man to shore. As two ambulances pulled up with sirens, wailing in that European pitch that sounds to American ears like a World War II air raid, the medics jumped out of the ambulance and they tried to resuscitate this man, but it was too late. And I watched from the top of the seawall as they pulled this cloth over the man's body and they stepped back. And the daughter, she threw herself down on the rocks next to him and she was just howling in grief. The crowd was around me and I was watching from the promenade in horror as the scene unfolded. When I heard it was the girl's father, I ran to a payphone, and this is back when we used payphones, to call my own father to make sure, irrationally, that he was still alive. He assured me he wasn't going anywhere and that it was a gorgeous beach day in Miami and he'd be coming to France in a couple weeks. My father was always going a million miles a minute. You could find him driving 80 down the highway, fishing around in the center compartment of his car, or driving his boat over pounding waves, or careering down a ski slope with ski poles just sort of trailing askew behind him as he yelled, "Hey-ya!" I always worried about his safety, and often my own, when I was with him. At the same time, he was so full of life and so much fun, and I loved him fiercely. When I was 16, we took a family trip to Costa Rica, and we rode on a small prop plane, where I insisted on sitting in front so that I would die first if we crashed. I also almost drowned on that trip because I worried about him bounding through those big Pacific Ocean waves without a care, even though he was not at all athletic and probably should not have been in that water at all. But in trying to keep up with him in the ocean, I ended up eating a mouthful of sand and, you know, I got scared. I'm the one who almost died. My dad just sort of went for it in every situation. When it came to a crisis, though, he was the least dramatic person I'd ever met. He was at the epicenter of the 1994 Los Angeles earthquake, which he reacted to by saying, "It's just a couple of dishes. Go back to sleep." Though he no doubt loved us, he was not family-oriented in the traditional sense. As adults, we didn't do holidays, but we talked often in quick bursts. He always checked in on me to tell me he loved me, give counsel, and discuss my sister's lives, his life, and mine. Some of these calls were long, but often they were under a minute. Sometimes I felt like a horse had just run through my living room and out the back door. I was in my late 30s when my father decided to tell us about his cancer. He'd had prostate cancer, but was just back from his 5-year scan and had a clean bill of health. We were very angry he kept it from us and made him promise that if it ever came back, he'd tell us. And he agreed. About a year later, my father was in New York for a meeting and took us to lunch before heading back to the airport. When he got home, he called and said that the meeting was really a visit with his oncologist at Sloan Kettering. His PSA levels had risen again. The cancer was back, but under control. He quickly switched the topic to how he had the best doctor on the planet, was getting the best treatments, and told us how slow-growing a cancer it was. "Chances are something else is going to get me," he would say, which was true. Prostate cancer is a slow-growing cancer, and usually the patient dies from something else, especially if they get it later in life. He reminded us of our good genes and sent us an article on Ashkenazi longevity. It was winter. The day after Christmas, my ex-husband and I were driving through a snowstorm in New Hampshire listening to the Antlers album Hospice. The first bar of the song Kettering, as in the same hospital where my father's amazing doctor was, made me feel crushing despair, and I told my ex-husband, "We can't listen to that." He shut it off. We drove in silence the rest of the way back to the house where we were house-sitting. By spring, I had started fertility treatments because I wasn't getting pregnant and I was almost 40. Finally, we gave in and did IVF. We learned we had 3 good embryos and went out for Mexican food in Fort Greene to celebrate. While we were getting seated, my dad called and asked if I had time to talk. I said sure and went outside to take the call, still buzzing in the early spring air from the good news. He told me his cancer was now stage 4 in his bones and it was incurable. I tried to bargain with him, using lots of buts. I was accustomed to his reassurances, but I didn't get any. He told me, "Your dad's not going to get better," talking about himself in the third person. I went back to the table and collapsed in my seat, leaving my dinner cold on the table. My husband quickly paid the bill and we headed home. A friend and her boyfriend came to visit that weekend from Barcelona, and I couldn't stop crying wherever we went. She wasn't a close friend, but her nonchalance changed the way I looked at her. Since then, have quietly distanced myself from her. I don't even know if we've ever even spoken since then. Resurrection. A few years passed, and his stage 4 cancer still hadn't moved. It was not in the lymph nodes and not in any vital organs. He was doing all the state-of-the-art treatments with the prostate guy in New York, with coordinated care from his oncologist in Miami. A year after my children were born, he was in New York, and we went out for a beer. He sat across the table from me and I told him that my marriage was ending. He held my hands in his and said, "Oh, honey," and his eyes filled with tears. I shifted in my seat because his expression made me feel how real this news was. I hadn't said it out loud until I said it to my father that day. And I certainly had not yet made any concrete plans to leave, but it was true. My marriage was over. I also felt I let him down, or that circumstances did, because I knew he wanted to have another man take over as my hero. He trusted in my ability to accomplish anything, but he still wanted me to have, I suppose, what he couldn't give me as a father. He once told me something along the lines of, "You want someone to open the car door for you, to help you in these ways, not because you're incapable of doing it yourself or helpless, but because it'll always be harder for a woman in this world because we live in a sexist society. So it just makes it a little bit easier, and it's just nice to have that help." I don't know if you agree with this or not, but for me, I understood it meant you could be both strong and need help and support, a concept that didn't come naturally. My eventual divorce was dramatic. My father had a second chance to become the hero he was when I was a kid. He helped me stay tough and centered through all the custody stuff. We talked every day during that period. He talked me through every decision and kept me clear and grounded in my own value and my rights. After that, my father came to visit me in South Carolina, where I had gone to seek refuge in my separation, to see me and my twin daughters, who he adored. One looks just like him, and I think we all saw the blessing in that. She would carry him forward in her features, pass him on. He was also careful to treat me like a daughter and not like the mother of his grandchildren during a time when I had completely forgotten about myself. Still, after my divorce was final, we went back to talking more infrequently. He visited maybe once a year, and I really treasured those times, but they were just too infrequent. He loved us, but he was not available in a way that any of us wanted or needed. And it made me feel angry and helpless. At one point, I told him, "Fine, I guess we won't see you before you die." And I might have even called him an asshole. I'm pretty sure I called him an asshole. On our calls, my dad told me the same stuff about his doctor and the treatments, always announcing some measure of good news. His PSA levels were down. There'd been a breakthrough, and they've never seen numbers go down so fast. At one point, he said that it was possible that one particular treatment could completely eradicate the cancer. "It looks like something else will get me before the cancer," he announced. "Your dad's going to stick around a long time." One day during this period, I was driving around on my lunch break, trying to escape the doldrums of a job I couldn't stand, when my father called with his usual updates after a doctor visit. He told me he was taking the breast cancer medication Lynparza because a year back, his star doctor ran tests to see if his cancer was germ or gene-based, and it was gene-based, and so this medicine could lower his PSA. Then he added, "You know, my doctor said you and your sisters should go get checked out too because you have a 50-50 chance of having the same gene." He said this so casually. I mentioned Angelina Jolie, who famously had a preventative double mastectomy. "Is this the gene mutation Angelina Jolie has?" He said, "I think so, but that was years ago and you can probably just take a pill for it now." My sister, who's a TV producer at ABC News, got the same news I did and read up on the BRCA gene mutations my father was announcing he had, and yes, that Angelina Jolie has, except she had BRCA 2 and he had BRCA 1, and decided ahead of time that if she tested positive, she would have the preventative double mastectomy and hysterectomy. She said she'd already met with a genetic counselor and she got tested first. I said I thought her preemptive decision was drastic. A few weeks later, she got the news that her test came back negative, and I instantly knew in my heart I was positive. I didn't have a single doubt, in fact, and I was terrified. I'd been reading up too. There ain't no pill for BRCA. I took the test and waited for the bad news, which came 3 weeks later. I was BRCA 2 positive, just like my dad. I immediately called my long-distance boyfriend, who said, "What am I supposed to do about it? We all die." Later, he told me that he had to do a million push-ups that morning to stave off the pain that he was feeling. He was so mad at life and the fact that I had cancer. I had to continuously remind him that I, in fact, did not have cancer. He was in such anguish over my news that he went off and slept with another woman during this period, and pretty much all of the periods of our relationship together. I think he was always sort of in anguish about something about me. He was really selfless. I then announced to my dad that I was going to do the surgeries, and he said I was being impulsive and making a mistake. I told him, "No, I'm not making a mistake," and thanked him for saving my life. During my pre-op, they found something in one of my breasts, and I had a biopsy. I didn't expect them to find anything, and I also didn't expect a biopsy to hurt so much. speaking about this post-divorce boyfriend I had, when they clipped the skin, the snapping sound was so loud I jumped. But as soon as that second snap occurred, it just jolted me into a clarity about what kind of person this guy was, which I later was persuaded to forget in my grief. As my surgeries approached, unfortunately, I took that boyfriend back. I think I thought I needed him. Obviously, I did not, but this is a vulnerable time, and like divorce, you're really not coming at it with a purely logical mindset. Like I talked about, when you revisit the same image, or a book, a movie, a place, hindsight alters your view of what has occurred. So I went ahead, and I got the first of the two breast surgeries, the double mastectomy, before going back in and getting the reconstructive surgery, which in my case was a delayed direct implant procedure, which I highly recommend if you're able to do that. Not everybody is. My dad was noticeably absent during this. It was later in Charleston that he made it clear that he didn't approve and thought I had unnecessarily mutilated myself, in his words. In the weeks before he died, he had an about face and told me, "You did the right thing." 2018 was the year of my complete hysterectomy. By 2019, my dad's voice began to sound hoarse and distant on the phone. He seemed confused by small things and told me old stories from his childhood over and over, sprinkled now with Yiddish words. My father had never spoken a word of Yiddish before. He surprised us and planned that beach vacation I'd asked for, out of the blue, and my younger sister flew in from LA and my older sister flew in from New York. We met in Jacksonville, Florida, a place none of us had ever been, but a place that was convenient for me to drive to with twins in a convenient airport for the others. I grew up on boats and in oceans, pools, and rivers with my dad. On this trip, we went to a janky water theme park and skipped the beach. He didn't go in the water at all this time. He and I shared a hotel room. He didn't sleep well, though, and I was up too. In the middle of the night, we chatted. He told me about his leg pain. I said, "Oh, from the treatment?" And he said, "No, from the cancer." This was the first time he admitted that he was feeling pain from cancer. In group texts, the women in our family started to discuss what we should do about my father. "How bad is it? We don't know. Should we move down to Miami? I can't with my kids in school. I'm in finals. I can't leave work." We kept asking him if we should visit, and he kept saying, "No, not now," until one day I realized I had to stop asking. I didn't debate it with my sisters or my mother, who was going to have to watch my kids. I just booked a flight, brought my kids to my mother, and went. I will add here that my mother, she tried to protest and say, "I'm not the babysitter, and your dad's always dying." I said, "Mom, I'm going," and I left the kids with her. We spent 3 days together where I recorded him telling stories about people he'd known throughout his life. I listened, trying not to interrupt, and asked my most pressing questions wherever I could. You can hear me laughing a lot on the recordings. The second day I was there, his mood and energy was markedly improved. His wife was astounded, as he'd been quiet and not moving around much. We went to Starbucks and bought bagels, and then the next day he said, "Come on, let's go to lunch." One of my best friends, who was in remission from uterine cancer, called while we were there, and they got on the phone together, and I heard him basically tell her goodbye, saying how much he'd always appreciated the cards and gifts she sent him and the friendship she'd offered him over the years. She's an extraordinary person who sends her friends creative gifts and cards regularly. She counted my father as one of her friends. When I left Miami, he asked me to please go get my kids and come right back. 2 weeks later, my sister and I met at Disney World with my twins and then drove the rest of the way down to my father's. I'm not going to go into the state he was in when we got there. He was still sitting up and still cracking jokes, but he didn't look good. He didn't look good at all. We didn't leave the house on this trip. We just sat inside and talked. I felt like I was suffocating at one point, a feeling I'd never gotten with my father. I said, "I have to take a break. I've got to go see a childhood friend," and he asked me to stay a little longer. This person, who was the least clingy, most hasty and breezy person I'd ever met, suddenly didn't want me to go. I stayed another half hour, all the while feeling like I couldn't breathe. The next week, I went to a music festival in Atlanta with that wonderful guy that I was dating. He had bought us tickets 6 months earlier. My sisters and I kept texting my father and then texting his wife, "Should we come back?" He had gone into and come out of the hospital because of something to do with his heart. They weren't responding much to texts, and then at a certain point, they both stopped responding altogether. I felt an undercurrent of impending doom during the weekend, which came to a head when I was sitting on a hill, looking down on a sea of old rockers and millennials listening to Tame Impala sing "Let It Happen," which goes, "All this running around, trying to cover my shadow, an ocean growing inside, all the others seem shallow. All this running around, bearing down on my shoulders, I can hear an alarm. It must be a warning. I heard about a whirlwind that's coming round. It's going to carry off all that isn't bound. And when it happens, I'm going to be holding on. So let it happen. Let it happen. Then my dad's wife texted my sister, it's time to come back, if you're coming. I drove to South Carolina and got on a flight the following afternoon, leaving my kids with my mom rather forcefully. She was getting tired of this, my father is going to die stuff. I texted my sister as I boarded the plane. She had already arrived and asked how he was doing. Her reply, not good, be prepared. On the plane, I started editing a letter I'd been writing to my father for over a month. It didn't feel good enough. I had to read it to him, though. I knew that. When I got to his house, my sisters were standing outside holding hands, just looking at me with an expression I will never forget. I didn't make it in time. I felt like it would be an intrusion of something, not sure what to write more about what happened at that point on this platform. So I won't. I'll just say I went inside and saw him, and it left me dangling in midair. My soul left my body when his soul left his. I have so much more to say, but I don't want to be too precious, and I need to get this one small thing out there. Here's a little aside. Years ago, before any of this, I applied to a low residency MFA program at Oxford, which was a hybrid literature and writing program. They wanted you to know your stuff when it came to pretty obscure genres like operettas and radio plays. They asked me who some of my favorite new playwrights were, and I didn't even have an answer. At that point in the interview, I knew I was toast. My writing sample got me to interview, but these two very English poetry professors were not pleased with my lack of expansive cross-genre reading experience, as well as this answer. They asked me what I would want to write next, and I told them maybe a screenplay about my dad and his life in Miami in the 80s. An uncomfortable silence ensued. I don't know when I will start writing about my dad, or transcribe the recordings of his stories to make sense of the time and place in history that formed him, but I know I've done a lot to avoid feeling the pain of his death, and that I have not even begun to process it. I wrote this in 2019, and I still feel like I'm only on the very edges of that grief. One byproduct of my years of preparing for losing him was pouring energy into undeserving people, mitigating the pain of a real loss. All those years that I was checking to make sure he was alive, and now I'm working hard to grasp the fact that he is not. Let it happen. Easier said than done.
You've been listening to Actual People. This show is written, directed, and executive produced by me, your host, Chauncey Zalkin. Show sound designed by Eric Aaron. Click on the link below to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. And don't forget to leave a review. I'll be sharing my favorites. You can find our socials and all links to deeper dives into these topics at chaunceyzalkin.com and on my Substack at chaunceyzalkin.substack.com. Actual People is available wherever you get your podcasts.